Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Unwavering, The Wives Who Fought to Ensure No Man Is Left Behind, by Taylor Baldwin Kyland and Judy Silverstein Gray, narrated by Susan Erickson. Introduction. This is a story about a small group of women in the 1960s who did what few women in that era could. They bucked tradition and, in fighting for the men they loved, forever changed U.S. foreign policy. It is a story about a tribe of ladies who became accidental activists during one of the most tumultuous times in our nation's history. Amidst the din and confusion of the Vietnam War, the anti-war movement, civil rights marches, and the Watergate scandal, this band of wives galvanized a president and a nation around the plight of their husbands, some 1,500 men held as prisoners of war or missing in action in Southeast Asia. This is more than a wives' tale. Unintentionally, this small cadre of women made the POWs and MIAs so valuable that getting them home became the only victory left for our nation. Bringing home a small group of men who represented a fraction of the 58,000 war casualties became the focus of the peace negotiations. Every war produces prisoners. But only since the Vietnam War have prisoners become political hostages, so valuable that preventing them in future wars has become a strategic imperative, not for humanitarian reasons, but to avoid having to make compromises to get them home. The United States will still tolerate casualties, but will not tolerate missing men or POWs. Our military's increased use of unmanned technology helps avoid this threat. We now expend unlimited resources, deploying special forces to rescue just one POW, whether that man is in Bosnia, Iraq, Somalia, or Afghanistan. It is no accident that America ended its longest war in Afghanistan without a single POW or missing man. The United States says that we hold sacred the mantra, "Leave no man behind," but that has not always been true. Every other war in our nation's history produced thousands of unrecovered missing men. 81,600 in World War II and 6,497 in the Korean War. Only since the Vietnam War have we upheld this promise. Only since the Vietnam War have we spent hundreds of millions of dollars every year combing the globe for missing men from all of our wars. Only since the Vietnam War have we hoisted the black and white POW/MIA flag above the White House, the Capitol, and each post office in the United States to remind us of our sacred promise to find every missing man, dead or alive. You cannot drive 5 miles in this country without seeing one. With its stark white silhouette, the flag signals that wars are not over until all troops have returned home. Credit for our dedication to leaving no man behind belongs to the small group of women who in October 1969 took diplomatic matters into their own hands. Keep listening and travel back in time with us to take an intimate look at the upended lives of a handful of women as they coped with the capture or disappearance of their husbands. We immerse you in the action and the history of this tumultuous era as these women moved from the sidelines to the front lines of advocacy. Bravely marching up to enemy headquarters on the outskirts of Paris, they insisted on a seat at the diplomatic table. In doing so, they set in motion a wholesale shift in military policy. These are their stories. Part 1. To the Front Lines, 1964 to 1970. Chapter 1. Tea in Paris, October 1969. The Parisian suburb seems unusually quiet. It has been raining for days, scattering and matting clumps of leaves on the sidewalks. A noticeable chill hangs in the air. The sound of heels clicking on the sidewalk pierces the silence as five American women stride in a single file toward a dark stone building surrounded by an imposing wall. Sybil Stockdale has organized the group in formation to keep them focused, on track, and on time. She sighs at her reaction in the puddles. The rain has flattened her new haircut, and she is not certain she likes the effect. At 44, she feels careworn compared to the younger women, but she picks up the pace, taking the lead. The overcast skies do little to warm their welcome as they reach the iron gate of the modest building. Smoothing her skirt, Candy Parrish fishes her lipstick from her purse and refreshes the color on her lips without a mirror. Taking a deep breath, she musters the last bits of energy she has stored for this meeting. A former airline hostess with a striking resemblance to British fashion model Twiggy, Candy is known for her bubbly personality. But the stress of the past year has dampened her spirits. The mother of an exuberant toddler, she spends her days chasing Hunter around an empty house. Her emotions seesaw between delight in raising her little boy and anxiety over her missing husband. Waiting for any news about his fate has been a torment. Perhaps it is her burning desire to introduce her son to his father that has brought her to Paris. Maybe it is the urging of naval intelligence officials who have coached her to recall names and faces so she can identify specific people. Or it could be the lure of a confrontation with the North Vietnamese enemy who might be holding her husband captive. Perhaps it is all three. Whatever it is, Candy knows she must take matters into her own hands. Sybil and Candy are not alone. Three other women and one man accompany them, several meeting for the first time at John F. Kennedy International Airport. The group is advocating for men from each of the armed services, Americans held as prisoners of war or missing in action in South Vietnam, North Vietnam, or Laos. Sybil Stockdale is de facto den mother. Doe-eyed but stoic, Mary Ann, Pat, Mearns, a nurse and former airline hostess, is the mother of two young girls. She, too, is seeking answers about her husband, an Air Force aviator missing since 1966. An introvert, she follows Sybil's lead and gets in line. Slender and perfectly manicured Andrea Rander is the only wife of an enlisted man. She is also the only black woman. Her husband is a POW, captured in South Vietnam during the Tet Offensive in 1968. Statuesque Ruth Ann Parisho, the wife of a naval aviator missing since 1967, rounds out the pack. The lone man, Tom Swain, is the father-in-law of a missing Marine and chief of staff to the governor of Minnesota. He acts as a chaperone. This is the 1960s. A group of women traveling for business without male accompaniment is uncommon. Sybil has had a hand in recruiting the women to represent a cross-section of missing and captive men. They have been holed up for 6 days at the Intercontinental Hotel in Paris, waiting for the meeting. The plush hotel is far beyond the budgets of these military wives. The bill for their travel and accommodations is being underwritten by defense contractor Fairchild Hiller Aircraft and Reader's Digest magazine. American and international media have been alerted to the risky summit the women are trying to arrange, attending press conferences at the airports in New York and Paris. The women have gone to great lengths to arrange for childcare, as family and friends step in to assist. Sybil frets that nosy reporters might frighten the four boys she has left behind in California. And, as American anti-war protesters grow increasingly aggressive, she yearns to shield her sons from incessant news reports about the growing divide between anti-war activists and those supporting U.S. troops and President Richard Nixon. She knows it seems paranoid, but she worries communists might kidnap her sons while she is overseas. All the women are concerned that the meeting with the North Vietnamese might never happen. Nerves are fraying. Candy's suitcase is lost, and she does not have enough cash for new clothes in a place like Paris. Women did not have credit cards in 1969. She keeps recycling the puffy-sleeved outfit she wore on the plane, and she borrows Ruth Ann's hair rollers. Other than letting the women embark on a 2-hour shopping excursion, Sybil has sequestered the group in the hotel. She has forbidden them from talking to anyone, especially to the media. They feel like prisoners in one of the most beautiful cities in the world. Tempers flare and bickering ensues. To combat fears and boost morale, Sybil sets rules and a daily schedule. Each morning, she musters the group in her room. Armed with a yellow legal pad and whipping out the pencil stashed behind her ear, she drills the wives. She has them rehearse the statements they are going to make if they secure a meeting. Then she fires questions as they sit side by side on a settee, Sybil coaching their delivery until their answers are just right. If reporters show up, only she and Tom will talk. That week, Sybil was both den mother and dictator, Andrea remembers. I looked up to her. By day 4, the women know how to make their case. Dressed conservatively, Sybil resists the ubiquitous and trendy miniskirts. Her jowls belie her age and weariness, but she has a hearty laugh that lights up her face. That is, when she allows herself to laugh. Serving as the anchor for this group, she is determined and decisive, but can seem unapproachable. Her husband's long absence, longer than any of the other women's husbands, weighs her down. She is also weighed down by a secret she keeps. Sybil knows that her husband and other POWs in Hanoi are being tortured. She cannot share what she knows or how. The others attribute the anguish etched on her face to age and weariness. This is a serious mission. Candy overhears Sybil telling Pat Mearns that she would manage the upstarts on the trip. Put off by the comment, Candy may not grasp the burden Sybil carries. Sybil wants the group to place the North Vietnamese on the defensive. There isn't much the women can control on this trip, but they should master their emotions. Be calm and cool, she tells herself, and the others. Before breakfast, Sybil dials the North Vietnamese delegation on the black rotary phone in her hotel room. In a rehearsed and professional voice, she firmly requests a meeting. A representative from the delegation answers icily and curtly, "The ladies will have to wait." Each afternoon, Sybil sits by the phone in anticipation of a return call. She has been advised not to contact the U.S. Embassy in Paris unless there is an emergency. Officially, there is no government sponsorship of this trip. They are on their own. But Sybil, Candy, and Ruth Ann received unofficial guidance from their contacts in the military intelligence community. They were shown photos of North Vietnamese officials and taught to remember what they might see, hear, and observe, especially any notable physical reactions. As the sun sets each afternoon, the group grows more anxious. 5 long days tick by, each blending into the next. They are in Paris, the city of lights and love, but surrounded by overcast skies and only a few miles from the enemy. How patient should they be? They are not experienced in international diplomacy and have limited financial resources. October 4th, the sixth day, dawns gray and drizzly. It is a Saturday, and hopes for a weekend meeting are dim. Sybil sips her coffee, thinking about how to keep the group engaged. Nearly jumping out of her chair, she grabs the armrest when the phone rings. Her heart skips a beat when she hears the cold voice that she has been talking to every morning. "Please come to the Choisy-le-Roi this afternoon at 4 p.m. for tea." Click. The building that beckons in Choisy-le-Roi serves as the Parisian offices of the delegation from the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, North Vietnam. For more than a year, protracted negotiations called the Paris Peace Talks have been taking place there between the communist regime of North Vietnam, the Republic of Vietnam, South Vietnam, and the United States. Little progress has been made. Back home, nightly news broadcasts highlight how long it takes to agree upon laborious details like the size and shape of the negotiating table. Meetings are held weekly, something Sybil is grateful the POWs do not know. It wasn't a very convincing demonstration that either side was anxious for progress, she noted. Increasingly, she is cynical about the war and her country's leadership. As she performs her last rehearsal alone in front of the hotel mirror, Sybil's anxiety is overwhelming. She is exhausted, even though she has been taking a sleeping pill each night. She has been dry heaving, but she does not want anyone to know. Candy recognizes her emotional distress. She was on her way to a nervous breakdown. Something was off. It just wasn't right. Sybil plows on. This is their one shot to request an in-person, honest, and full accounting of the men the North Vietnamese are holding captive and those that are missing. She reviews the script and the plan with the group one last time. They grab their notes, powder their noses, and head out for the 40-minute taxi ride. North Vietnamese officials meet them at the gate, escorting them into a dimly lit room. Spacious, it is sparsely decorated. Oriental rugs cover a worn wooden floor. Low-slung furniture is arranged around 2 formica-top tables, a picture of oxen hangs on a wall, and a model of an ox cart sits on the table. Coarse linen curtains make the room seem even darker and the mood heavier. But they do not muffle the dissonant sound of someone playing billiards nearby. Four slender and diminutive North Vietnamese officials in drab suits with mandarin collars stand silently, watching the group intently. When the men sit down, their too short pants reveal skinny socks and pale, scrawny legs. Sybil is in a deep, easy chair with heavily upholstered cushions, facing Xuan On, the senior representative of the delegation. Later, she describes him as enigmatic-looking. The other three men never introduce themselves. Sybil makes meticulous mental notes of what they look like, assigning them mnemonic nicknames, brown suit, Mr. X, and glasses. The deep seats make it awkward for the women to sit politely in skirts. Andrea's knees rise close to her face. Convinced the seating is intended to unnerve them, Candy almost giggles out loud while she struggles for modesty. An image of Ho Chi Minh, the recently deceased North Vietnamese prime minister and president, looms over the group. It may be a photograph, but he is an ominous presence. The gloom casts a sense of doom over the group. Andrea's eyes dart around as she squints at the doors. What is behind them? Naively, she believes her husband might be at this house, ready to return with her to the United States. Tea, stale crackers, and Vietnamese candies are served. It is a strange tea party. The group sips from cups, trying to balance their saucers and steady their shaking hands from clanking the porcelain cups. The North Vietnamese stare blankly at the women. Sybil gives the signal to Candy. She clears her throat, sits forward, and recites her statement, pleading for information about her husband, Navy Lieutenant Charles Chuck Parrish, missing for more than a year. Why can't they tell her if he is alive or dead? Well, responds On, it is difficult to know whether men are missing in Vietnam or not, because of various reasons, either because other countries are involved, or because some planes are shot down over water, some are lost at night, some are on fire. He asks her to write down the specifics of Chuck's shoot-down and loss date. Then, he told me I reminded him of his younger sister. He says her husband has just been killed by an American bomb. On pauses, letting his statement sink in. Candy is not naive. She knows what he is trying to do. Somehow she finds him personable. Even though she knew he was a politician, skilled in poker-face diplomacy, he seemed warmer than the others, at least to me. Ruth Ann speaks next, then Andrea, who is terrified. Unlike the other missing and captive men, Donald works in military intelligence and has briefed her to never discuss his work. But I had to say who I was, and that I knew by then that he had been captured in the South. Andrea wonders if their hosts suspect the women are dupes of their government. And what do they think of her? They see this brown face in there. Look what's going on in the United States, you know. People are being killed and the civil rights are going on. They must wonder, she thinks, how did she get involved? Next up is Pat. Carefully, she recounts what she knows of the incident where her husband, Air Force Major Arthur Mearns, was shot out of the sky on November 11, 1966. She beseeches her hosts, what do I tell my children? They have been without a father for almost 3 years. Silence. They just sat there. Their faces were placid. Tom speaks about his missing son-in-law. Finally, it is Sybil's turn. Although she has practiced her statement many times, she is too nervous to recite it from memory. But she cannot see. Darkness is descending, and the room is awash in shadows. Sybil asks to borrow reading spectacles from glasses. He acquiesces, slowly handing them to her. For a few seconds, all pretenses fall away, giving her a fleeting sense of control. Sybil relishes the moment. She relays her husband's shoot down and capture. I know Jim was injured, but I have no evidence his injuries have been given proper treatment. Sybil wants a report for each captive's circumstances and an accounting for the missing as required by the 1954 Geneva Convention. An awkward silence fills the room. Suddenly, stone-faced On stands up, pulling a folded New York Times article with a photo of Sybil from his pocket. We know all about you, Mrs. Stockdale. Sybil blinks, staring back at him. The ticking of a clock in the background mimics her pounding heart. He leers. Does it not seem strange to you that for so many months the government was not concerned and talking about the prisoners and missing? And then the government started talking about them, and women started coming to Paris. Your government is using wives and families to draw attention away from the crimes and aggressions they are committing. Sybil can almost feel the blood congealing in her veins. On continues. We know you are the founder of this movement in your country. And we want to tell you, we think you should direct your questions to your own government. This is what the U.S. government had been warning the wives about for years. Talking in public might hurt their husbands and hamper the U.S. government's ability to negotiate their release. Keep quiet, they have been told repeatedly during the past 4 years. Clenching her jaw, Sybil composes a careful response, citing the list of government offices she and the rest of the wives have visited on Capitol Hill and elsewhere. She does not reveal that she has been unable to get an audience with the new president, Richard Nixon. Dull stares from the North Vietnamese. It does not seem to matter what she says. Her spirits sink. Out of his pocket, On fishes a letter from a group of North Vietnamese women to American wives of POWs and MIAs. He apologizes for the poor translation and reads aloud. You don't really know what trouble is compared to our trouble. We want to live in peace with you. American prisoners get food which some of us have to go without so the Americans can be well fed. Sybil knows otherwise. Candy watches the tennis match of words between Sybil and On intently, trying to memorize the faces of the four North Vietnamese men. Mr. X's beady eyes reveal his disdain. He sneers when Sybil speaks. Candy absorbs details about the room and the conversation so she can debrief Pentagon intelligence officers when she returns home. The women hand over a thick stack of letters, some 700 of them, from 500 families of missing and captive men requesting delivery. On reluctantly takes the bundle, making no guarantees. Furthermore, he questions why the women claim they are receiving so little news from their men. I believe that letters from your husbands are being confiscated by the Pentagon or the State Department. Dismissively, An says it is not necessary for more relatives to visit the delegation.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?